I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello. Hello. In the back. I'm sorry we're so small. What a time to be reading a novel called I Am Sovereign. There are some writers you thank your stars for the fact you're alive at the same time as. I think it is no exaggeration to say that I am glad to be alive at the same time as Nicola Barker, one of the most original writers at work in any of the written forms right now, and one of the most original of our writers ever and yet. She is a visionary writer. I know that because before Twitter, and I was reading Behindlings, where a lot of people follow a chap about, they become his kind of followers. And I thought, gosh, she's foreseen Twitter. Years. Did you know that you were going to? Did you know what that was? That behind. Anyway, she is a visionary writer. She is a Daedalus of textual sensitivity. And I think that's. She's an inventor and a reformer of everything about the literary text, from the complete form itself down to the section, the redefinition of the paragraph, the sentence at sentence level and typeface level, all the way down to what she calls the tiny kaboom hand grenades of each and every comma. I Am Sovereign is a short novel about, oh God, summarise a Nicola Barker novel. It is about everything. It is about 20 minutes in the life of some people involved in a house viewing in Llandudno. It's about how we find a home for the human and a home for the soul. It's about the novel form. It's about the relationship between the words author and authority. And it is about whose story gets told and whose doesn't, and the ramifications and the responsibilities of this. It is all of this faster than the speed of light. She is a rejuvenator of this old island, language, literature. She is simultaneously a profound understander, often in the helter-skelter form of a wildly comic fiction like this one, of human tragedy, briefness, sensitivities, fragilities, our need for atonement, our natural surreality, our disturbing strangeness, our rich in strangeness. She's always been one of our most generous writers, too, most urgently primed to remind us what attentiveness means in the book, but also in the world. I remember reading in Wide Open, there's a character at one point sees a misshaped pig be born. It's just a head with a creature that's a freak extended, quote, elongated, the remainder of a body like a tiny moist mitten. And this character looks at this and then goes away, and then she thinks to herself, she should have saved the head. If only she could have touched it. If only it had needed understanding, but it had received none. Barker grants life, thoughts, and narrative this level of attention at all the levels. She grants them to an understanding of the pressure specifically true to the information and the disinformation ages that we're living. And for coming from such an ultra-contemporary talent, light years ahead, formerly, of all the other novelists writing in English right now, her work has a taproot deep in the metaphysical. Recently, I was at a reading that she gave for students at a college, and she read from I Am Sovereign, and she spoke at length about devotional writing and about notions of the soul. And the place was packed, and I saw these teachers of some of these students sitting at the back, and I saw them kind of wince when she started to speak about something so outré as the soul, you know. And then at question-asking section of the evening, the first question from a young student in the front row whose face was shining was, can you tell us some more about the soul. And then the next question from someone else, and I looked and there was another member of staff who now was just evanescent with light, excitement. She's a specialist in ellipsis, and suddenly I saw her find herself in having heard Nicola speak. And next to her, there was a student who said, can you tell us some more texts where people write about the soul? And then the next question was, can you talk about the articulation of the soul? I mean, Nicola's been interested since she started writing in what she calls, in a story back in 1996, the world soul. The story was called Inside Information, and in it, the world soul is, quote, a democratic body of pinpricks of light, an enormous institution. And in the story, a newly pregnant woman discovers she's got a zip in her side now that she's pregnant, and she starts shoplifting things and hiding them in with the fetus. And the fetus complains bitterly about this to the world soul. So, in other words, she has been publishing brilliant, unreservedly original short and long fiction since 1994, has won and been shortlisted, etc. It's all on Wikipedia, and none of it prepares you for your first encounter with a Barker text, or your next. The most recent of her prize winnings is the Goldsmiths Prize, one of the best and most courageous of the prizes on the circuit, a couple of years ago for her last novel, Happy. Happy. How do you say it?
H-A-P-P-Y.
H-A-P-P-Y. It's got brackets around the A. Which, to all intents and purposes, she says at the end of this book, the author has been prey to mixed feelings about the novel as a form ever since completing her last work, Happy, which, to all intents and purposes, destroyed the novel as a form for the author.
It's like a little burp.
From which burp Nicola Barker will now read, and I'll ask her some questions, and then we'll open it to the floor. Please welcome Nicola Barker.
I must just say before I read that it would be criminal to have Ellie Smith here and to not get, she'll be furious, to not get her to read from Spring. So I have bought my copy of Spring.
Oh, Nicola.
Because I feel as if now is the time to hear those first few pages of that book, now more than ever before. And yes, because Ellie writes about what's happening now in a way more kind of coherent and direct way than I do. So I just would love to hear it, and I've brought it along, and she's going to have to do it, so everyone will get to enjoy that. But I have said that I don't want her to read too close to me, because I don't want the comparison. So we're going to do my little bit, and then I want Ellie just to do something at the end, and then everyone's free to ask Ellie questions as well. it would be...
You aren't.
It would be a crime
for her not
to. You actually
aren't, because I'm
the
chair.
You are. So, you are going to.
Just before you start, actually, what about the word sovereign right now to you? What are you thinking about right in this time of the question of sovereignty and the attack on sovereignty and the taking over of sovereignty? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, sovereignty? I'm just... I should think it's quite obvious what I think, yeah. But that wasn't the main thing I was thinking about when I was writing the book. It wasn't the main thing I was thinking about, but it's been really intriguing for me how people have really embraced that and responded to it, especially in the right-wing press. I was really delighted. Someone, I think in the Mail, had really appreciated it and was very suspicious of me, which I was delighted by. But but also touched because my worldview is that any kind compromise is necessary. Everything beautiful comes from compromise. Everything good comes from compromise. You know, I believe in the virtue of suffering. All very unfashionable things, but these are, you know. So that's what I think about it, really. You know, which not very, but what I think about it at some level is entirely written into what you've written about it. Mm-hmm. You know, that it, in a way that makes me, because I'm quite cynical about the novel as a form now. When I read your book, it did make me understand what the point was of it and how it could be something beautiful and how it could be something necessary and how it was meaningful. So that's why I want you to do that little bit of a reading. So I can't really articulate that as well as you can. No. So that's Ellie's job. She's going to do that later for us.
So
So I'm going to read, I've done a reading with Ellie before, and I read from the start of the book, which I find the most amusing bit. But I refuse to read in front of her the same thing twice. So I'm going to read something from later on in the book, which is where, as the author, I interrupt the book and make a few apologies. We apologize in advance for the brief interruption, but it is necessary at this moment in the novella, henceforth referred to as I Am Sovereign, to warn the reader that Nicola Barker, henceforth referred to as the author, has been granted absolutely no access to the thoughts and feelings of the character Gayasi Chance Igbo, henceforth referred to as the subject. At his inception, the subject seemed not only a willing but an actively enthusiastic participant in the project, yet after several weeks of engagement became increasingly cynical and uncooperative to the point of threatening to withdraw from the enterprise altogether if the author deigned to encroach unduly upon his interior life. For this reason, where possible, the author has attempted, with the subject's permission, to sidestep his wanton opacity by calmly theorizing on the subject's possible feelings, slash thoughts, slash motivations, and then transcribing these ideas into the text using an entirely different font. The standard font is Baskerville. The subject has requested American typewriter as an alternative for the chapters in which he is to be heavily featured. American typewriter was agreed upon after lengthy consultations with the subject. The author should make it plain that American typewriter is a font that does not permit the use of italicization, something that she worries, in the light of her ebullient style, may ultimately be inhibiting to the feel and flow of I Am Sovereign. If this is indeed the case, the author apologizes, again, unreservedly. It would be difficult, nay, foolish, for the author to speculate at this juncture on the whys and the wherefores of the subject's taciturnity. The author is both saddened and frustrated by the subject's seeming unwillingness to place his trust slash confidence in her, the author's, natural sense of balance and fair play in relation to this slash her texts. The author has informed the subject via telepathy and WhatsApp, that she is merely trying to tell the simple, almost trite story of a 20-odd minute house viewing in Clandidno, during which the subject makes a brief, relatively inconsequential appearance. But the subject, while accepting that he was conceived of as present during said viewing, is determined to remain abstruse, impenetrable, and enigmatic. The subject also disagrees with the idea that his appearance is merely inconsequential, but rather describes his role as climactic, even seminal. The author is unconvinced that the subject understands the real meaning of the word seminal. The author wishes the reader to understand that she thought long and hard about cutting the subject from I Am Sovereign altogether, but ultimately felt that to do so would involve a profound compromise of her febrile and unconstrained imagination. The subject is unconvinced that the author understands the real meaning of the word febrile. The author sincerely hopes that the reader will extend a measure of compassion and understanding towards herself slash the text during the following three chapters and do their best to work with the author in imagining the extraordinary richness and diversity of the subject's potential role as it was originally conceived in I Am Sovereign. The subject also sincerely hopes that the reader will extend a measure of compassion and understanding towards himself, his rights to self-determination during the following three chapters, and do their best to work with him in imagining the extraordinary richness and diversity of his actual role, as opposed to the role he is to be patronizingly gifted by the author in I Am Sovereign. The author wishes to make it clear, and she feels that this actually goes without saying, although she is saying it, that it has been necessary to make certain very subtle adjustments to I Am Sovereign in order to try and counterbalance the problems engendered by the subject's unexpected reticence. Novels are finely honed and delicate organisms. The character of Wang Shu, for example, has been greatly reduced and simplified as a consequence of these necessary adjustments. In the original version, Wang Shu spent only a fraction of her time on the phone talking in Chinese. Several pages in which Wang Shu spoke most touchingly and evocatively about her skill in playing the erhu, a traditional tu air in Chinese, stringed instrument with its horsetail and bamboo bow and box-like body, featuring, among other exotica, python skin, were summarily eradicated. These included the moving story of Wang Shu's unsuccessful, nay, borderline tragic audition for the Guangzhou Symphony Youth Orchestra as a teenager, her shows of extraordinary bravery and persistence in bouncing back from this terrible disappointment, and her eventual joyous slash life-affirming acceptance into the National Youth Orchestra of China. In some senses, these scenes represented an exquisite, and all the more so for being both utterly unexpected and immensely well-judged, opening up of Wang Shu, and the author sincerely considers them to be among some of the finest work she has ever produced. The subject would not agree with this particular value judgment. The character of Morpheus was added to I Am Sovereign in the final draft. In the earlier version, a kitten called Cindy featured, but this kitten was a tortoiseshell long hair, and the subject became irritated by the way her fur kept marking his white jeans and compromising his look, even though Charles kindly supplied him with a selection of lint rollers throughout the writing of I Am Sovereign's first draft. The subject would like it to be known that the author insisted on his wearing white jeans when, in fact, he had preferred to wear grey moleskin jodhpurs. Finally, it should be noted that in the original version of I Am Sovereign, the character of Abigail at no point vacates the property on Tai Isa Road. Due to her high levels of professionalism, the character Abigail would never willingly leave clients in the lurch while showing a vendor's home. To do so would run counter to her very nature. The subject finds it frankly laughable that Abigail's professionalism should be mentioned in this context. He has no idea what relevance Abigail's professionalism or want of professionalism has to do with the issue at hand. In some senses, the author considers it little short of a tragedy that the subject's decisions have impacted so heavily on I Am Sovereign as a whole, but strenuously maintains that she respects his choices and ultimately bears the subject no lasting ill will. The subject calls this final statement by the author sentimental, sententious poppycock.
Is it true? What you just read?
It kind of is true.
Yeah.
It is true. I had problems engaging with him, I suddenly didn't feel I wanted to.
Talk about that in a minute as well, about the ways in which some people get to be at the centre of a narrative and others don't, which is one of the gifts of this book, an understanding of the responsibilities that we hold towards people and narratives both at once. So you finished Happy. And H-A-P-P-Y.
Yeah.
And it had left you thinking you were not going to write another novel.
It did.
So where did this come from?
It wasn't a... obviously, I make a living writing novels, so it was an uncomfortable realisation.
Yeah.
But I did feel as if something had... imploded for me, just in terms of how I saw narrative. So, I did think, and I still think, actually, it sounds weird. It's all to do with numbers. It's all to do with the death of things and the birth of things and how those two things are so closely intertwined. But I did feel as if I had reached the end of what I needed to say as a novelist, and that my tools had almost kind of disappeared, that they'd evaporated. So this book is just kind of, it is like a strange afterthought. So I'm still very much in that. I mean, not in a dramatic way, in a quite calm, happy way. I'm still in that place, yes.
Okay. And when we open it, the first thing you read is the epigraph, the T.S. Eliot epigraph.
Beautiful.
Which is really beautiful.
Yeah.
Where is the life we have lost in living?
Yes.
Is that where it started, this book? Did it come from the Eliot?
Yes, because I did an event here. I can't remember when it was, but not that long ago, and I had to read a lot of Eliot and think about Eliot a lot. And obviously, he's been a huge influence on me. But I hadn't I didn't know that much about him, and it was just extraordinary finding out all of these things about him, and especially his relationship just to language and to faith. Uh-huh. And I felt an immense sympathy and empathy for him. But yes, the quote is that where is the life we've lost in living? And it kind of feels so true. And I almost feel as if fiction is a way of capturing that life and condensing it and making it real. And I think certainly for me as a novelist, I think I've spent my whole adult life retreating into fiction. Fiction has been a retreat for me, and I've lived inside fiction. And I think with Happy, that kind of exploded. I was writing something only this morning about this idea, and I was thinking about you, and I thought, I wonder if Ali feels that about fiction. I wonder if fiction has ever been a retreat for you, because I don't feel as if it is. I feel as if your relationship is more tender and loving towards the novel than mine.
I don't feel that your relationship with fiction has ever been a retreat. When I think of your fiction, it may have seemed like a retreat for you, but in the world, it's like a set of architectures that are blown wide open to us so that we can see the structure of things and at the same time think, how could we live?
Yeah. But I think I think it was a lovely place for me to live inside fiction. Huh. And there are no regrets. I've loved living inside it.
And you're saying that in the past tense.
I've been buried in fiction. I have been looked... I know, I was thinking this again today. Yeah. I have been really looked after. I think at some level the same has applied to you. Like, I've been really tended by people. I've been really protected by editors and publishers and agents and in a really lovely way. And I think they've all taken me seriously, when perhaps I've never taken myself that seriously. And so there's a like immense amount of gratitude for that. And yes.
But does but you're still talking, you're kind of talking about that as if something is still ended rather than that something has moved forward.
I do feel that a tiny bit.
But the origin of this immense ball of life that is I Am
Yeah,
Sovereign.
My dad works as a realtor in America.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in his late 70s, and he works selling real estate in America. And he was telling me about, and he gets really involved in the people's lives. And he was just telling me on the phone how he was doing all of these things for this old, he called him an old guy, but the guy was probably younger than he is. And he was like cutting down trees to try and sell the property. And he was doing all these different things. And it just made me laugh. And I thought, wow, he's so involved in the sale of these properties. And it just seemed like a beautiful, such a tender thing. And then I was in Llandudno, where my mother lives just outside Llandudno, and we were walking down the promenade, and I just looked to my left, and there was a little road, and it was absolutely covered in birdshit and gulls. And I just suddenly felt really drawn to walk down it. And I said to her, can we just walk down that road? Uh-huh. And as soon as I walked onto it, I thought, this is where a book must be set. It just immediately, and that's how it is with me in place. And I walked down the street, and then I saw the little property, and I thought, that's the place, that's the house where something's going to happen. Yeah, so that was the start of it.
That's lovely. Charles, who can't get started.
Yeah, no.
Abigail, who's running away from significance in capital letters. Yeah. Wang Xu and Ying Yui, a mother and daughter viewing the house, who are themselves mirrors of compatibility and incompatibility. Yeah. It's about self-help.
Yes, absolutely.
All in a book, the chapter headings of which are the slogans of ironic T-shirts.
Yeah.
Ask me about my vow of silence.
They're real.
But that's the thing, isn't it? The point where the fiction meets the real, I suppose, is what I'm asking with that, because those YouTube stars are real people.
Oh, no, I mean, I only...
Richard Brannan and Lucy Molloy.
I'm very respectful. Whenever I use people in a book, it's always respectfully, and it's always because they've inspired me or enthused me in some way, and certainly Richard Brannan, I think, is an extraordinary talent and like a brilliant man. And very much recommend people watch him on YouTube. He's fabulous. I absolutely love him. So I wanted him to feature in the book.
Okay.
So when I use
Does
real...
he know? Does he read your book?
I sent it to him, but I had no response, and I'm not surprised. I thought it was a great compliment to him. I'm really admiring of him. But yes, there was a moment of pause. There was a moment of anxiety, because he crushed me immediately, but he just ignored me, and I think that was for the best, really.
Is Richard Grant and the man who does the hand?
Yes, yeah, okay. Hand mnemonic.
Tell them about the hand mnemonic, please.
Oh, yes. So the hand mnemonic is, this is to help, victims of trauma. And I'm trying to remember it now. Now the pressure is on. So the hand, what is the first one? I am sovereign.
Yes, I am sovereign.
So you say, I am sovereign on the thumb. Okay. You tap the opposite hand to your... So I'm sovereign, I'm queen of my own serenity. Mm-hmm. I am sovereign, so I'm in charge of everything I'm doing. This finger, you point at the inner critic. You point at it, whatever it is, the negative voice in your head. You point at it, you say, I know who you are, I know what you're doing, you're the inner critic, I'm not going to listen, I am sovereign. The third one is saying no, boundaries. Yes, so the third one is, yes, boundaries. Know when to say no to other people and to yourself. The fourth one is self-partnering. Yes, so partnering the self, yes, no, drinking enough water.
Yes.
Yes, eating sensibly, going to bed at 11 o'clock, after 11.
Very good.
So that's self-partnering. Okay. And then the last one is, how am I feeling? How am I feeling? Because people never ask themselves how they're feeling. They never actually feel things. They just ignore how they're feeling and move forward. So it's like, how am I feeling? And you interrogate your feelings and you have to ask yourself repeatedly, how am I feeling right now? How am I actually feeling? Mm. So that's the hand mnemonic.
Okay.
Richard Grant's hand mnemonic.
And Lucy Malloy.
Lucy Malloy, she is very, very heavily tattooed. She's beautiful and she's very, very heavily tattooed. And she has a distinctive facial tattoo. And she is a star on YouTube. And I don't know how I came across her, but she seems to live such a sort of mundane life for someone really heavily tattooed. And she's very conventional. No, but she's very conventional. And you follow her exploits. You know, she's going to the shop or she's like doing really, really, you know, she's eating bagels. And there she is, heavily tattooed. And you're like, and there's something so mundane about her that it was... just intriguing. Fascinated me.
Did you send her a copy?
No, I didn't send her a copy, no. She is married to the Australian tattoo artist, Malloy. Her husband, anyway, is a famous tattoo artist. She has the most beautiful Kali on her back, like huge Kali, which I'm very admiring of.
So in a way, all these people just meet in this kitchen.
They meet in the house viewing, yeah. And it lasts for 20 minutes, and that is essentially the novel. It's just
one of them is on the phone speaking in Chinese.
Yes, the mother figure. Yes, she's always on the phone throughout the book. She's constantly on the phone speaking in Chinese. We have no idea what she's talking about.
And Abigail.
But we do find out what she's talking about.
We do find out at the end, but
that's later on.
And her daughter.
Her daughter, Yin Yu, is a kind of exquisitely innocent. And I suppose...
Exquisitely innocent.
No, but she is, isn't she? She's incredibly innocent / vacuous, and there's no way of telling which it is. But my life philosophy, I mean, I have two really, but my life philosophy is ferocious innocence. That's my thing.
That's how I live. The phrase at the center of this book, ferocious innocence.
That's me. So that's where.
What's your other motto?
Well, my love of paradox, my love of contradiction.
Okay, so ferocious
the pair
guilt.
Of opposites.
Ferocious guilt, ferocious innocence?
Yes.
Opposite of innocence is what? If it's the opposite, you're living in paradox.
A cynicism.
Cynicism.
Yes.
There is...
I refuse to be cynical.
The best thing. I mean, I read this book... Nicola's talking about it in spring. I read this book in the spring, in April, and I was... It is as if it restores your innocence, to read this book. And that's an impossible thing to do. That's a miraculous thing to do. But this notion of innocence being ferocious, I want to ask you to say more about that.
Yes. Well, I'm Richard Grannan, weirdly, undermined my ideas about ferocious innocence, which is something I've held dear for quite a few years, because he calls it neurotic innocence. So he doesn't like. Yeah, so it's like, is it neurotic?
But that's a different kind of innocence, isn't it?
Well, neurotic innocence isn't good. That means you're someone who gets exploited.
Yeah.
But I am not going to be exploited. I'm ferociously innocent. Yeah. I consider that different. So I'm aware of people trying to exploit me. But I remain innocent in the face of that.
Ferocious in protection of your innocence. Ferocious with
In the protection. So it happens in all... That's why I'm always saying this to Ali, because I always end up doing things with Ali, because I won't do them in general. And then they say, oh, Annie's doing it. I'm like, oh, I suppose I'll have to do it then. So I don't do much stuff like this, because my whole thing is that the work comes from the unconscious.
Yes, absolutely.
And and so I can't talk about it.
Because how can we talk about it? Go away, all of you. Because we can't talk. We can't actually talk about it. It's almost impossible to talk about it. And when you do talk about it, it empties out the thing you do.
That's exactly it. So it becomes, when you repeat things enough, it becomes a cliche. Yeah. Doesn't it? So
not that you're really not really good with cliche. I mean, you're really. I think actually, you love cliche. You're passionate about cliche.
I don't want to live cliche.
I was once on a panel with a young American writer sitting next to me here who said, "If anyone ever gave me a Hallmark card, I would never be able to speak to that person again." And I remember, actually, you came into my head at this point. I was like, I know what Nicola Barker can do with a Hallmark card. And now I know the kind of writer you are and the kind of writer that I love. Yeah.
If we
empty out the meaning for ourselves by saying it or by articulating it even.
I did and this must happen to you all the time. I mean, all the time. And so I don't know how you remain so productive. But I do very little. And I went on an Arts Council thing to Russia. I think it was like 3 years ago.
Was it?
And it was the first exchange between English writers, first group of English writers, British writers actually, going to, mainly Scottish, going to Russia. Mm. And I was always on the end of the line. And everybody else had a lot to say about the novel. And I was at the end, and I was obviously ferociously innocent. So I was like, I can't really say anything. I'm too innocent. I don't think about things. It's all connected to the unconscious.
Yes.
Like, this would be too hard for me to have an opinion.
But it's true. This is the paradox. This is your other matter. This is the paradox.
So you say that two or three times at the end of the panel, at the end of the line, you're like, oh, I hate myself. My ferocious innocence. It was unbearable. I did begin to hate myself. I began to hate the fact that I wasn't able to contribute because I was so ferociously innocent.
Oh, but I don't like that thing coming anywhere near your ferocious innocence.
No, it did.
Which we need in the world, your ferocious innocence. Is the author truly sovereign? That's the question that's asked in I Am Sovereign. From what you were reading. So here's Gyazi Chance Igbo, your character, your taciturn character, who turns around and argues back, enters the text to correct things. And you and he are actually locked in combat, as you say. And in the last pages of the novel, we find out wrenchingly where he comes from.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do a spoiler.
Yeah,
but it's about how little space he has been allowed in the world as well as the world of narrative.
I suppose we're also I think I'm also saying whether I have the right to tell his story. Mm. But so I do have mixed feelings about that. Mm-hmm. But also I hope that I would. Mm. But I know that that's up for grabs now, all these kinds of ideas. And I think it puts the novelist in a very complicated position. So I'm sort of trying to engage with that.
Okay.
I have a friend who's an excellent writer and very religious, and he wants to write a book about the Virgin Mary. And he was just told that it wouldn't be appropriate for a man to write a book about the Virgin Mary.
Who told him that?
He was just advised that, and he was really upset.
Advised
in general. So that really disturbed me. That really worried me. Yeah. So I suppose there's a kind of flavour of that anxiety creeping into the novel. I do think as time passes, it does become harder to be as free. So I'm not as free now. Okay. And you do feel these, and I refuse to feel them, obviously, because I'm ferociously innocent. I refuse to, and the novel is for you and for me, and this is the thing I think we share. The novel is playful and it's mischievous for us, and it's
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Joyful. And you can't be restricted. You can't apply, you can't pay attention to rules and to certain forms of etiquette. You can't, because you can't be free. Yeah. And we can't, I don't think the joy is there if you can't be free.
So talk to me about exactly that, about the way you play all the time with typeface, with the very notion of the word, with the notion of something on a page.
Yeah. It's all, it really is all just...
With colour, as you did
yes,
in Happy.
Yes, it's all just accidental with me. So there's no... Ali and I have talked previously, haven't we, about how Ali is way more... No, don't grunt, because you did agree with me. Ali is way more considered, and she's more of an intellectual than me. Because I know, but it really is true.
Laughing, no,
we have to... It really is true, because I am a bit of a dunce in general, aren't I? I don't retain facts, and I walk into furniture. Whereas Ali... Ali is well-read, and she is considered. No, you are considered, and you bring that to the novel. Whereas I don't bring that. I just bring... there's a kind of spontaneous energy, but it is quite silly.
Kidding.
No, it isn't. No, that really is how it is. I'll retain facts for a short period of time, and then boom, it's gone.
Oh no, same, absolutely same with me.
Well, I don't think
no,
so.
It's absolutely. Anyway, stop that talking about me, because what I really want to talk about that intervention of the author, who has been more and more present in your work.
Yeah,
and I'm remembering the point that in the approaches where there's a character who is wearing a sweater that is three sizes too small because he doesn't want to offend the person who knitted it for him. But it's so small that it's actually causing red wheels around his neck and his wrists. And he's like this the time, and he gets really angry at the cow author, Nicola Barker, who has put him in this book and treated him in this way. Yeah. And he says, why didn't Edna O'Brien write me? Why am I stuck with Nicola Barker? But this is it makes me think of Spark, Muriel Spark. It is the key to Spark's work, that the question of the character talking to the author is about the ways in which we live in belief or in faith, or in the structures which we call belief and faith, by which we're made.
Yeah.
So therefore those characters from the get-go, Muriel Spark writing in The Comforters with her character going, I am not going to live by your plot. Typewriting ghost. There's a character called Caroline in The Comforters. She starts as she's living her normal, sort of realist, novelist life, to hear a typewriter tip, 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 and she hears what's happening to her own story, as it were, in voices in the room. And she hears what she calls the typewriting ghost, which then she realizes is producing her reality. And she's like, I'm not fictional. Who are you calling me fictional? I'm not fictional. That relationship in the Catholic novelists, particularly summed up in Spark's work from the get-go, about the relationship between the author, the authority, the system of belief, and the fictional character at the basis of it.
Yeah. I think, I do worry, though, that when the author enters the text, it is the beginning of the end, really. So I think the fact that I've appeared more and more, and I'm very present in this one, I do think that's... So I'm bringing everyone down. But that is actually quite, I think that is quite worrying.
Or is it just the end of
because,
the beginning?
Because
is it the point after which you have broken the novel open to such an extent that you can get to the something...
Well, I would hope so.
Authentic, absolutely yes. Authentic, that is in fiction, that is utterly true to us. And it is the metaphysical.
Yeah? Yes. I would see my work in general as an attempt to describe the indescribable.
Yeah.
And to find transcendence through kind of confusion. That's sort of the function of the novel for me. Yeah. But, yes.
So when we sat in that college with those students and you talked about the soul and about devotional writings.
Yeah.
Tell them about the
yes,
soul.
Yes, no, there was... no, I was simply saying that I've been reading about the soul. Yeah. And that the journey for me over recent years is obviously I'm religious, which is very unfashionable. I'm religious. But I would call that spiritual. And that's the spirit. But for many years, I don't think I considered that the soul was different to the spirit. And that's something I've been thinking about in recent years. And I've been reading some really wonderful archetypal psychologists, one who is called Thomas More, influenced by James Hillman, who is a great kind of the master of this world, of this particular, type of psychology. And so and they talk a lot about the soul. And I'm very preoccupied by the idea of knowledge and how knowledge, the ancient Greeks saw it as being divided between logos and mythos, and how our current world is totally logos. Yeah. And what a shame that is, what a tragedy that is, because mythos is really the point of everything, the soul feeling. It doesn't have to be religious feeling. It can just be soulfulness. And so, I realized that my spirit energy is head energy and my soul energy had always been heart energy. And those two things were never quite at ease with each other. And so in the last year or two, with HAPPY, there was a kind of terrible eruption and a kind of...
The point at which you're talking about fiction in that book, or the fictions or the narratives we live by, as either cathedral or slum. Mm. I mean, this interests me, that dichotomy that you drew in that book, between the things by which we live. Are we living in the slum, or are we living in that great edifice which we can create?
Yeah. That huge, which was in fact only made out of equations in the book. It was like this huge buzzing equation.
Virtual
the
cathedral.
The book goes so nuts at the end.
Virtual
so
cathedral.
So nuts.
That you were born in Ely.
Yes, I was. Yes. I was born right near that beautiful cathedral.
Whenever I get to the part of HAPPY where... the narrative has become the cathedral again. I think that cathedral which was over your birth.
Yes.
But then out you went into the world after that.
Yeah.
To across the world, to live in, you lived in Africa.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Live in South Africa for a long time.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yes, very complex. That's why a lot of my early work was about islands, because moving from a very tiny island and a small community into this huge expanse, which was morally complex, and a very dark period of my life. And so I think that's what really made me a writer, was this sense of distance and dislocation, and also a real feeling of moral responsibility, which I think in the UK they couldn't understand that. And even when I returned...
What do you mean they couldn't understand that?
I don't think morality was expressed in everyday life in quite such an extreme form.
Okay.
And my mother worked for the Learning Post, which was a big... black newspaper, and we were compelled to leave. Mm. So there was nothing shameful about it, but there was still an immense shame, and you carry it in your voice and you carry it in everything. And that's a really important part of what made me a writer, trying to understand feelings of guilt and responsibility, and of how you can be responsible for things even when you've not done something, or just all of these very subtle and slight ideas connected to responsibility and morality. Yeah.
Connected to responsibility, morality, to notions of God, and to notions of the imagination as well.
Yeah.
Right back in your first novel, there's a character who says, every thought, idea, commentary, fiction was travelling towards a single meaning. She tried to find this meaning, but it was hopeless. It was too big. It was nothing. That one meaning might have to be God, she decided, which would be like a defeat. And yet there's another character who, way back in that novel, says the imagination gives her total liberation, because there were all these things she could imagine happening also, and this was the wonderful part, the amazing part, she could imagine just as easily these same things not happening. So I
have no memory of writing.
I think though that positioning of the balance of God and the imagination, the notions of God and the notions of the imagination have been at work in your work.
They have,
since
yes.
the start. Yeah.
I had to go to there was a seminar in Manchester on my work last year.
Oh,
and
what
so
was that
lots
like?
Of papers. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it because I had no memory of my work. So it's like, wow, this is great. What kind of a nutter wrote this stuff? But I was just laughing throughout. I enjoyed it so much. It was like, I had no memory of writing the stories. It was like totally mysterious to me. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
So weird.
Okay.
I never think about the work that's done. I'm always thinking ahead. I never think about it. I write it and then I completely forget about it. So
or it comes through you from that subconscious or unconscious place.
Yeah, which, I think so.
Which we can't articulate. Until yeah. I was at an event last week where Nicola Sturgeon was interviewing Arundhati Roy, and she said to Arundhati Roy, "Summarize the Ministry of Utmost Happiness." And Arundhati Roy went, "Why? How would I? How could I?" She said, "Because you can't. Because that is exactly that. That it comes through us. So there's no way that you could say anything other than the thing that you write." Given that, and given that you said that you are at the moment in what feels like afterthought to the novel form, what is the novel form for? I mean, there's a question. What does it do in the world? And is it a moral form? I suppose I'm thinking of the preoccupation all the way through your.
I don't
work
think it always is
the work you've forgotten with good and bad, and with. I mean, I think of Wesley. That character who is both, you know, a religion and a man, who feeds his fingers to an owl in an act of atonement. And, and then I thought, I was at another event where Elif Shafak said the most interesting thing. She said, the novel is a democratic space.
Really?
And then in Clear, in your novel Clear, that you won't remember, the liberating statement, there is no right or wrong in fiction.
So cruel to quote these things at me. There is no right
there's There's your character in Clear who says there's no right or wrong in fiction. The story's just the story.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes. Don't agree with that.
that character is a particular white boy.
Don't remember any of that. Yeah. No. Yeah. How strange. Yeah.
Anyway, what's the novel form for? What does it do?
I don't know. For me, it's. I think for some people, it is a way of. It's a way of people reflecting, seeing themselves in. Like a lot of novels are about people seeing themselves and feeling comforted. So lots of books are about comfort, aren't they? And reassurance. I feel as if the form can be reassuring. I think in my novels aren't reassuring. My novels are challenging. And that's what I love to do. I love to challenge. And so if you're going to be challenged, there has to be space. The reader has to say, when you live in a culture where everything is about you, the novels, my novels certainly, they say, well, you're going to actually have to step into this world. This isn't all about you. And you're going to have to, I'm going to make a tiny bit of room for you, but not much. And I'm not going to reflect you. And like, see what happens. Try it. Challenge yourself. And I remember reading Henry James. I always say this, reading Henry James as a teenager and just struggling with every sentence and really hating every moment of it. And then getting to a point in the book after all this struggle and just bursting into tears. And I didn't even know why. And there was just a moment of incredible kind of confusion, and joyfulness and transcendence. And I didn't know what it had done or how he'd done it. And after that happened to me, I thought, I wish I could do something like that. I wish I could throw language against gaps, against impossibility, and throw language against it so that a shape is formed, like this extraordinary, this whole, this something full of possibility. And that's what I wanted to do. That's what Henry James taught me, and that's what the novel is to me. But it's a rarefied thing, and I totally get that. It's an obscure thing, but I do think it's sustaining, and I do think novelists like me and writers like me, and there are a few of us, that we are like the bottom feeders. We are like at the very bottom of the ocean, but we feed higher up. So even though very few people read us, I do think that we're thinking about things and we're working in ways that are valuable to the culture at large, but just maybe it takes a while for things to percolate through. Now, obviously,
now it's time for audience questions.
No,
so
now
who's got a question, your hand up quickly
Who wants Ali to read? Just the first two pages, because they are like so incredibly beautiful. It's going to happen. Ali did this. I'm just going to...
Well, you think of some questions. Okay, and I'll read for a little. I'll read for 30 seconds.
Okay. I owed Ali a huge favour because she came to Faversham, where I live, and she did her first... It was your first event, wasn't it, for spring? And she came and did a reading
Before it was published, actually.
It was complete insanity. It was the most beautiful, the magical night. Sarah, Ellie's partner, came and showed her films. Yeah. And the two of them, night. I mean, it really was the most beautiful, magical thing. And people were blown away by the two of you. And especially the beginning of this book. And I just saw even the kids that were working the bar, just their jaws dropped when they heard Ellie read. So I just wanted to hear it again. And
hands up for questions for Nicola Barker after the next 10 seconds, okay? Okay. Now, what we don't want is facts. What we want is bewilderment. What we want is repetition. What we want is repetition. What we want is people in power saying, the truth is not the truth. What we want is elected members of parliament saying, knife getting heated, stuck in our front and twisted. Things like, bring your own noose. We want governing members of parliament in the House of Commons shouting, kill yourself, at opposition members of parliament. We want powerful people saying they want other powerful people chopped up in bags in my freezer. We want Muslim women a joke in the newspaper column. We want the laugh. We want the sound of that laugh behind them everywhere they go. We want the people we call foreign to feel foreign. We need to make it clear they can't have rights unless we say so. Questions now, please, for Nicola.
Oh, that was a cop-out.
No. But we are living extraordinary, extraordinary times, and we are really in need of extraordinary, extraordinary writers who can remind us what it means to think that we are sovereign and to find out that we are not sovereign and to find out what it is that uses us to make itself so-calledly sovereign. Hands up for Nicola Barker, please, for questions. Come on. Thank you.
Of course, there was a good Henry James joke in your book as well. I never thought I'd laugh about it. The Golden Bowl.
Which book was this?
in this one.
Is there one in there? Try to even remember that. It's gone.
Oh,
it's
well,
gone.
Perhaps my, my question fish. Rather than my comment. Ein Sof. I'd not come across the concept of Ein Sof.
Oh, really?
Before. And I looked it up on, obviously, as one does, and thought, still a bit. But could you just say a little bit about Ein Sof?
It's just the idea of God. Kabbalah, from ancient Jewish writing. So it's just a different way of describing God, I suppose. The unending, I think the exact translation is. So yes, that's essentially it. So it's not, I don't think it's complicated, you know? But I'm glad you engaged with it. It's very, very, very beautiful. A lot of those ideas, really quite wacky, but very lovely.
If you ever do feel frustrated or exhausted with the novel form, do you ever feel compelled to engage in other forms of expression, artistic expression, whether it's like visual arts or dance? Or
I'm 53. I think the world of dance is behind me now. But I started out, when I left university, I started out painting. So but I have an older sister, only one older sister. She's a graphic artist. So she was always, she's 2 years older, so she was always better at, art was her thing. She was always better at it than me. So I think when you have a sibling that's very good at something, just slightly older than you, you never quite engage with it because you're never as good as they are. But when I left university, I painted, and I had a little exhibition there, and I painted and did these huge pieces. But I see my work now as very visual. So when I'm writing, I see rather than hear, if you see what I mean. So I do see the novel, or I do see writing as a form of painting. So I'll always see the scene rather than imagine. I hate Twitter, but I do love Instagram. Mm. So I'm like, I'm always drawn to the visual rather than the written, which is odd, isn't it? But that's, so I see that as my thing, really.
But you make text visual. That's what you do.
Yes, I do. I love looking at things, and I love beautiful things. And even my Catholicism is all about the beauty of ritual. So I love anything that's beautiful and gilded, and it's very tacky, really. But that's, and I've moved to Faversham. My church there is Carmelite. So there's no incense, there's nothing gilded. And it's like a huge culture shock for me, like very traumatic for me. And I've had to learn, which I've really enjoyed doing, that I've had to learn that my reliance on beauty isn't necessary. And it's been beautiful in itself, yes. But so visual things are important to me, but I think it's good to one, learn the things that you love so that you can relearn.
Nicola, you said about as an adult, you retreated into fiction and you said, I love living in fiction. Mm-hmm. What type of fiction? What did you read? What excited you? What moved you? What inspired you?
When I was younger, when I was very small, until I was nine, we lived in the UK and we had TV. So I just watched a lot of TV with great enjoyment. And then my parents emigrated to South Africa and they hadn't invented TV there. So it was like, oh, no TV. and we had the local library and that's what I did. And, you know, we had the radio and we had the library. So I think that's probably why I became a writer, because I had that interruption, which is why I'm so tolerant of kids today, because that just wouldn't have happened for me if I'd had the distraction of the phone and all the other things that people have now. It really only by being deprived of things sometimes do you embrace them or appreciate them. So
it's good to be bored.
Well, that's totally my philosophy. It's like so much of my childhood was intense boredom, and I'm very grateful for it. And even now, I try to be bored a certain amount because it's so easy not to be bored. It's so easy to see yourself reflected in everything. Whereas as a child, of course, when I was a child, you were never reflected in anything at all. Like you just got told to do something or told to be quiet, and then you would just sit there bored, and that was life. Whereas now kids are indulged, aren't they? They're encouraged to do things and they're encouraged to be creative. But so I think it would be very different now if I was alive now. I would just be very happy just doing stuff. Mm. But I don't think I'd be creative. No.
Annie Smith said that your novel was an attempt to subvert sovereignty, to suggest that an individual is not identical to themselves. And I think you said in your towards the end of your talk that you were that when you created your characters, you tried to create that split, that lack of self-identity. Now it could be said that you are depriving them of their innocence, and if that's the case, why do you deny your characters what you yourself proclaim?
I think of my characters always as quite innocent. Like, I think all of the characters in I Am Sovereign are quite innocent. They're quite beautiful. And I always love my characters. I always invent people that I would love to spend time with. And I feel tenderly towards them. And I always appreciate how multifaceted they are. And I'm very tender towards them. So, no. But in terms of people being divided, I mean, of course, the most important thing about human beings is that we're divided between the conscious and the unconscious. And so we are organisms that parts of us don't understand other parts of us. That's exactly how we operate. So what an extraordinary thing. How strange that I do and say and behave in ways and have done, obviously, all the time, that I don't understand and that I can't comprehend. And I make decisions about things that don't make sense to me. And we all do it. And we all see... What I love is that we all see the hypocrisy and the contradiction in other people, but never in ourselves. we are actually almost incapable of seeing it in ourselves. But I really embrace that in myself. And that's my love of Hinduism, of Kali worship. There's something called the pair of opposites, which is a really beautiful Hindu idea. And it's about how something and its opposite are directly related, and how they... You know, so creation and destruction in Kali are completely related to each other. They are actually opposites, but they are absolutely conjoined. And I see the human being, I mean, obviously people, we are pairs of opposites. We are terrible contradictions. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that in myself. I'm okay with the fact that I'm very religious and also kind of really irresponsible. There are two very different sides to me. And, It had been confusing for me for many years, and then one day I just thought, it's okay, just be a bit contradictory. It's actually okay. In the East, they don't have a problem with that. Whereas we think it's hypocrisy. But I say no to that. You know, I say it's okay. It's okay to think two things at the same time. It's all right.
How are we doing for time, Clara? One or two more, yes, please. So another couple of questions, please. There's one. Thank you.
I haven't read your book yet. Would you say I would be missing out something terribly if I were to listen to your book rather than read it, given the visual playfulness of the book?
Oh, that's an odd one, isn't it? I suppose it depends how expressive the person is, but I do see text as very visual. That's just me. I love to see the text, and my work is unjustified. So I never bothered to learn how books should look. Just didn't, even though I read a lot of them, I didn't retain that information. So I always just wrote in my own way. And so the text on the page is slightly different. And I feel as if, and sometimes they would be designed at a particular point in the publishing process. And I would see the book and it would be completely different. So I didn't, so all of the little jokes and all of the little pauses in the text and a lot of the subtle ideas in the text I felt were lost, because how I justify the text is intrinsic to how the book feels to me and how the line runs. And Ali does the same stuff. I see it in her books and she does it so beautifully.
Not to the extent that you do, though.
No,
was there a point where you actually did enter the publishing industry, as it were, and say, I want this to happen?
When I wrote, I had an editor called Claire Rehill, and at one point, I think it was for Darkmans, I said to her, actually, why not just don't have a designer, don't change it, I just want it to look exactly as it is. And she listened to me, and she published the book. Of course, I didn't bother to look at it again till it came out. And then I opened it, and I was like, oh, shit, they've used the same font I used. And it was like the worst font on earth. It was like the worst font. Because I always use a different font for each book just to keep me interested. It was like, oh, I can't believe they've used this dreadful font. And then a designer came up to me at some party and said, I can't believe you used that font. It's like the worst font on earth. I was like, I didn't intend for the... So she really took me literally and she didn't change anything. And it was like, what a mess.
Yeah.
Reading your work, I've often thought it feels and sounds and looks very much like poetry. Do you actually write poetry, or do you like reading it?
No, I love poetry, though, and I feel the same way with Elliot. Like, it's something when I read her work. It's just the same energy, isn't it, that we have. It's like a love of words, and it's like a happiness, and it's just something so minute to do with the way the words sit on the page and how the lines are and how... It's such a subtle thing, but it's...
When a novel is made of language, then you want the novel to be about language at all its levels, at its physical level, at its level of the reader taking in the language, and at the level of, as you do, the reconstruction of the paragraph section even. You know.
But it's very... I always read things out loud, as I'm sure you do, because you can just tell when you read Ellie's work that it's... You can just feel it, and it's. I feel that great... Yes, sympathy and empathy with her work for that reason. It's just, so you read it out loud and it has a particular kind of rhythm. And so it is very poetic, I think. It's just the joy of it. And I think it's just it's just the pleasure of it, isn't it? It's like really good coffee or something. I mean, you can have cheap coffee, but then you're like, oh, maybe it'll be just good coffee and it'll be just really subtle and really beautiful.
And one last question from someone, please. Hands up for the last question. Come on, there we are. Thank you.
You spoke earlier on about the Birchett strewn street as one origin of the book. I wonder, and you said that this is common, that a book begins or writing begins with place.
Yes, yes.
I wonder what these places have for you in common, because it would be quite easy and probably quite crude to say that you've written about places that seem kind of bleak, that have a certain emptiness. Yeah. There's like a Kentish version of that where you live now.
Yeah.
what is it that links these places?
Although this is the woman who moved to Faversham because of a Renaissance play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Arden of Faversham, my favourite place.
Yeah.
I think I find places that I find places, I'm respectful of place, like I find a place, and I'm respectful of it, and then I completely disregard everything about the place and re-inhabit it. So it's quite a kind of a violation of place sometimes, I think. And there's always a moment where, I don't know if this happens with you, where you feel just slightly guilty, like, I'm really exploiting place. But somehow I do it, and weirdly I often get, people often write to me and say, oh, I've lived here for years and I feel this way about that place. And that, it always delights me, as if you can intuit the very spirit and the energy of a place. But I do like to choose empty places and re-inhabit them. So I like to, why set things in places where it's so easy, where everything's possible and everything's there? Why not set it in a place where the characters can be the most important thing, and where, yes, there isn't too much meaning embedded in the place, and you can create your own meaning. And yes, and things like language and character and ideas can become come to the fore. Some kinds of places welcome that. Some places are sort of wistful or underused, or and it's not even a conscious choice. It's just something that you feel when you go to a place. You just suddenly know that it's perfect for you, and you just...
Is it something to do with the thing which all the arts are, which is the margins, so that the authentic voice comes from the margins? It just does. It always has done. It's been the voice that it kind of cuts through whatever the mainstream has made, which has now become dull or not of use to us.
Yeah.
But you always select places which are... You know places, you find places, you understand places where you can recenter the world, where the world can be re kind of wound and set round going again.
Yes. Yeah? I remember just as a child when I was in Africa, how the immensity and the lack of control. And I think so a lot of my books were set in islands or in places that were contained. And I think that was just my desire for containment and for kind of comfort and calm within a small environment. So that very much is a part of it. Less so now, but certainly for a period.
Well, I don't know how you define grace. I have absolutely no idea. But I know that pretty much every time I finish reading a Barker work, I love it. And I get to the end and the days pass, and 10 days, 2 weeks later, something opens above me about the re-centering of the world, the redefinition of what language is and can do, and how we live with it, and how it uses and lives with us, and the benignity of the possibilities of attentiveness at every level to the word and the world. Please thank Nicola Barker.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.